Author, poet and playwright Fiona Farrell has been publishing poetry in New Zealand since 1987 with her first collection, Cutting Out. She's also known for her scree of novels and plays and has been publishing almost constantly since the 1980s. But it's to poetry she's returned with her new collection, Nouns, Verbs, etc.
Pearl. This is the time for love. We know it. It's been around before. This is the time for turning to find life dancing at your heels. This is the time for licking new skin. This is the time when plum trees clap hands and dazzle. This is the time to gather stones together. This is the time when they crack into new leaf. This is the time when the earth puts down its cup and says, right, let's give it all another whirl, eh? And the moon draws us in on her sweet breath. And the sun draws us out.
Robert Kelly spoke to Fiona Farrell in our Christchurch studio about her new collection and the difficulties and opportunities of looking back.
That was the lovely thing about doing a selected poems, because I'd had all these scraps of paper in the bottom of a filing cabinet that I've had for years and years. They were just random scraps, really. Some of them were written on bits of bright yellow paper that the radiologists used when my husband had a student holiday job at Invercargill Hospital. They were typed on an old Remington typewriter. And then there were the earlier ones, which were handwritten and written when I was a teenager. I took a very long time before I started writing poetry, for publication, not till I was 35. So there were all these poems from childhood, and I'd collected them at some point when I was about 16, I think, and put them in a notebook. And it was a strange feeling seeing my whole life through poetry, really, right back to when I was 5 with my first poem, and then these poems in adolescence, the teenage ones, which were all angsty and about people not loving me and just full of that kind of teenage passion and anxiety. And it was lovely. It was like meeting another version of myself, someone that I sort of remembered. Like seeing yourself in a photograph, really, that you haven't seen before. It was lovely. Mm-hmm.
Do you recognise the woman who wrote those poems?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do. I can remember that feeling of puzzlement. I didn't find... I took a long time to grow up, I think. Adolescence was quite a puzzling time, and for me I think it lasted right through my 20s. Yeah. It was a very long adolescence. I felt very puzzled about who I was and what my life should be and what you did when you were growing up.
Can you see that in the poetry that you were writing at that time? Can you see that kind of, not arrested development, but... a kind of prolonged adolescence?
Well, yes, I can. A kind of it's got its beauties too. I mean, there's some things about it that I envy. That kind of passion and that kind of strong feeling. Those really strong feelings that you have when you're younger, and I loved that. That same strong feelings of love for unlikely people and strong feelings of anger at things that weren't working right. Yes, I feel a kind of affection for that person, yes.
So you mentioned that you were 35 when you first started writing for publication.
Yes.
Why did you make that decision?
Well, I'd been writing poetry right from childhood, as I say, and when I was about 19, I showed a poem that I'd written to a friend of my then boyfriend's, and he laughed at it, and he was dead right to laugh at it. It was a terrible sonnet, terribly pretentious, and not a very authentic kind of poetry. And so I put it all away. I didn't write poems except in these bits of paper that I shoved into the filing cabinet for years. And then when I was in my 30s, my early 30s, my dad died. And I think that was the first real, deep feeling that I had that couldn't be expressed anyway except through a poem. So I found myself writing a poem about that. And at that stage I was working as a drama teacher at Palmerston North Teachers College. I'm a terrible teacher, but I had a job there.
You need jobs. All writers need jobs.
Absolutely.
At some point or other.
You need some kind of meal ticket. And one of my colleagues, we shared a terrible little cramped office, and she had to climb over my chair practically to get to her desk. And she looked down and saw this poem. I was fiddling with it between classes. And she read it and she said, "That's really good. You should publish it." And I don't know, it was just the kind of little nudge I needed to think about sending something off in an envelope.
So one little nudge stopped you from publishing poetry when you were 19, and one little nudge prompted you back into it.
Yes, and I actually think that when I've been teaching, I haven't done any teaching for a long time of creative writing, but when I am teaching, I'm really aware of how tender that little shoot is when it's starting sometimes. Right. I mean, lots of people have the kind of ego that can sustain it, but some people have that kind of ego, but I think for most people it's a fairly tentative process to start with, and it's easily knocked back and it's easily revived again. So you have to be very careful when you're critiquing someone's first steps.
That's interesting. How do you think you revive that shoot? In a way that's not condescending?
Absolutely. Yes, you certainly don't want to patronise or condescend. I think try and see what the person is trying to say when they're arranging the words on the page, and to try and read it seriously and critically, but with an understanding of the purpose behind the poem, and try and focus the writer on what it is they're trying to do, so that if it hasn't quite succeeded, they're not defeated by that, and they see it as something that they can perhaps have another go at, or try again, or substitute a word, something like that, that there might be some adjustment they can make. So sometimes it's impossible. I mean, sometimes, you know,
there are bad writers.
Yes, there are, yes.
But you're trying to discover what they're trying to say rather than necessarily how they're saying it at that point.
Well, I think that's the important thing for me, is what you're trying to do. The how is another dimension to it. It has to be done well and arrestingly. A wee while ago, I looked at all the poems that had been published in New Zealand for the IIML's Best New Zealand Poems that they publish every year, wonderful process that they put in place every year. And I was the editor for that year. And it's a wonderfully diverse world, the poetry world. It's just such an exciting place to be. And when you come across the poem that just leaps off the page, where someone's got the right words in the right order, and they've said something and they've done something and they've created this object that's really fantastic, it's unmistakable and it's wonderful, and that's the excitement of it.
A lot of these new or newer poets that are coming out now, a lot of them are young female voices.
Yes.
That wasn't necessarily the case in terms of publication when you were starting to write.
No, not at all. I mean, there were some great poets around. There was Ruth Dallas and Fleur Adcock, Janet Frame, but they weren't... The publications that were available were largely taken up by male voices. I sort of grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and when you go back looking at, say, copies of Landfall from that era, it's a very, very male world. It's a post-war male world.
And quite white as well.
Yes, definitely. Yep, definitely. I mean, those kind of freedom movements, those great freedom movements of women and of race, they came through during the 70s and late 60s, and they gathered momentum during my lifetime. And I've been so lucky to be on that particular wave, actually, and that there were enough people who really decided that they wanted to speak and to be heard. And I was just part of that. It was just good luck. It was historical fortune, really, good fortune.
There's a sequence of poems or songs from your first collection, Cutting Out, titled Passengers,
yes,
which imagines the lives of women on arrival lists to Dunedin in the 19th century?
Not necessarily to Dunedin. A lot of them did come into Port Chalmers, but yes, they were young women. Actually, some of them were only 10, 11, 12 years old, but they were brought out by the government as assisted passengers, to be the servants and housekeepers and to be the wives who would turn this colony from being a colony mostly of men engaged in gold mining or pulling down kauri trees or all the other exploitative stuff that was going on at the time, and they were going to turn it into a stable colony. And so they needed a kind of breeding population, really, though it wasn't said in those terms. And so lots of young women, 12,000, were brought out on the ships, and I was very lucky to know a wonderful feminist historian, Charlotte MacDonald, who was working in Palmerston North at the time at Massey, and she'd been studying the passenger lists for the boats that brought these girls and women out. And in most cases, from those 12,000, they just disappeared into the fabric of the country. And pre-internet and pre-being able to look up your genetic background and your DNA and all that, most of them had simply disappeared. Their names had been forgotten. I'd been asked to do a play for the YWCA that would have lots of parts for girls to play, 20 of them. And so I took 20...
It's a big cast.
It was a big cast. They wanted lots of name, lots of people on stage. They want lots of singing and dancing. And so I wrote a play based on these passenger lists. We took 20 names, and with this group of young women and girls, we improvised and developed characters around the names and brought them back to life again. And at the end of the play, they all, one by one, step forward and say what's actually known, or what was known about those characters in real life, and then they step down into the audience and join the audience. It's still done, the play, and yes, I really love it as something that I've written, and I love seeing it when it's produced. Charlotte O'Neill's song. You rang your bell and I answered. I polished your parquet floor. I scraped out your grate and I washed your plate and I scrubbed till my hands were raw. You lay on a silken pillow. I lay on an attic cot. That's the way it should be, you said. That's the poor girl's lot. You dined at 8 and slept till late. I emptied your chamber pot. The rich man earns his castle, you said. The poor deserve the gate. But I'll never say sir or thank you, mum, and I'll not curtsy any more. You can bake your bread and make your bed and answer your own front door. I've cleaned your plate and I've cleaned your house and I've cleaned the clothes you wore. But now you're on your own, my dear, I won't be there any more. And I'll eat when I please and I'll sleep where I please. And you can open your own front door.
What's the difference between writing for a blank page and writing for a stage?
Oh, complete. Because when you're writing for the stage, which is how I started, my degree is actually in drama from the University of Toronto. I've got an MPhil in drama. So I started writing plays, little plays, for the students at the Teachers' College in Palmerston North, because we had all these students and they were supposed to teach drama in schools and do plays with large casts of children. And there were no New Zealand plays at all for that particular group. It was such a different world. It was such a Anglo-centric, America-centric world.
There really was no local content at all.
Virtually none, yeah. Virtually none. There was Bruce Mason. There were some writers, of course. But it was... It's hard to describe it now because it's such a different world.
Did it feel restricted at the time, or did it just feel like the way things are?
Well, it's always a blend, isn't it? It's always just the way things are. I don't know. Yes, you were aware of restriction. Yes, there was an impatience. I mean, that's what all those demonstrations and marches and Germaine Greer and all that, that was an expression of impatience. And we were young. I mean, it was a young movement. It was a movement of people in adolescence and in their 20s. And we were feeling restricted and restrained and impatient, and wanted the ability to be where we wanted and do what we wanted. Like, as Charlotte O'Neill says, you know, sleep where we please, eat when we please, all those things. And I think it's the same kind of impatience that gay people or that people of colour still feel and still express. I mean, it's not just women. It's that feeling of, it is a blend, it is the way things are, but there's also this feeling that it could be better.
Do you still feel restricted and impatient?
No, not necessarily. Well, I still react when I still have habits that I've retained from that feminist beginning. I still count up, it's a habit I have, I count up the number of female voices, the number of women in any publication where there's supposed to be equal representation. I'm still very aware of the need for diversity in any situation. You still read about the absence of female CEOs, of women making movies. It all changes and it shifts. But yes, I am still aware of all those things. I think once the feminists used to talk about the click of recognition, that you had this click when you recognised how it works, how things work, and your place in that pattern. And once that click has happened in your mind, in your consciousness, I don't think it ever goes away. You're always aware of it and sensitised to it. It becomes almost like an allergic response when you see people being put down or objectified or dismissed as being trivial or frivolous or irrelevant. And there's a kind of sensitivity to that that just touches that nerve ending. And yeah, it hasn't gone away. I don't think it ever will, to be honest.
That was author, playwright and poet Fiona Farrell speaking to Robert Kelly about her new collection of poems, Nouns, Verbs, etc., published by Otago University Press.